and I found out just after his father died, and apparently a couple of the kids said, oh, it's no wonder your father died. He couldn't put up with a stupid kid like you. And of course, he was bullied.
Welcome to this week's edition of Eye on the Peninsula, Tuesday the 24th of May, with Angela opening our program, sharing her personal journey and her newly launched charity. We'll hear more from Angela shortly. Good afternoon, I'm Piers Cunningham, broadcasting from the RPPFM studios in Mornington. Stories covered today include a discussion with the Australian Sex Party candidate to the Victorian Senate, Dr. Meredith Doig. We have more on the summer's footpath controversy. And Sina Subbers reports on equity and new knowledge for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander families. But first, some exciting news just announced. The Coalition will deliver a $2 million purpose-built athletics track for the Mornington Peninsula at the Civic Reserve if re-elected in the upcoming election. Here's a bit of the excitement around the announcement delivered by Mr. Chris Cruther, Liberal candidate for Dunkley, and the Honourable Greg Hunt, member for Flinders, from the Reserve in Mornington yesterday.
It's a fantastic announcement, and it wouldn't have happened without the help as well of Greg Hunt, the Minister for the Environment and the neighbouring electorate. This is a project that will benefit not only Mornington, but the whole peninsula, Western Port, Frankston, everywhere. I know how excited all your kids will be to have an Olympics facility, particularly in an Olympics year. And I know the slogan is, where is our track? Now the slogan can be, here is our track. So I might just pass to Greg, who will say a few words as well.
Obviously to Chris and to Bruce and everybody associated with the Mornington Little Ass Club, congratulations. You had the fight, you have won the fight, and what does it mean? It means that you're now going to have, you know, all other things being equal, a purpose-built, Olympic standard, synthetic athletics track here. It beats Mace Oval, it beats all the other options you've got. It's in the best possible place. Chris made this his number one local sporting task and had a fabulous go. Questions?
Is the track red or blue?
The track, I think the track should be whatever the kids club chooses. You can have the vote.
Orange.
It should be orange.
It's going to be an orange.
All right, interactive. Go on.
Is it going to be a 400 metre track?
It is going to be an Olympic standard 400 metre
track. That's right. And I'll just add, this would not have happened without the grassroots advocacy of all the mums, all the parents and the committee. It really has been a strong advocacy effort. You've been on Facebook, you've come to see me and Julie Bishop, you've come to see me and Greg, and I'm very proud to have announced this $2 million facility today.
Especially want to acknowledge Bev Colom and Carl Cowie, Bev as councillor, Carl as CEO of Mornington Peninsula Shire. More questions.
How long is it going to take to make the truck?
So, then I imagine, Carl, what's your best guess?
Excellent question, young man. I don't know is the short answer, but when you've got funding like this, clearly the Shire will put together the plan to get this built as quickly as possible because you're all desperately keen to use it. The space is here. There are very few limitations.
It's in the great spot.
It is. And I'll just add my thanks to the Mornington Shire Council, who have been advocating for this as well very strongly for a number of years, and particularly to all the kids here. All the kids here, but you've actually helped to make that voice very strong with your parents as well. So you've done a great job in actually achieving this today. And this is a facility that you will use for years and hopefully decades to come.
But there's a deal. Yeah. You've got a pledge to run faster, jump higher, and throw further. All right, that's great.
Hey kids, have a turn around, big cheer for your folks. They've done such a great effort.
Well done, the mums and dads.
Words from the president of the Mornington Little Athletics Club, Mike O'Donnell, mirror the enthusiasm and delight of the committee and kids.
I think it will drive relationships across a lot of sports along the community. Athletics is a foundation sport for all sports. Our athletes haven't had the facilities here to be able to do purpose training. We'll be able to set up a whole structure now around athletics in the community. On top of that, I think the space here is ideal with a growing area, with young population sitting here. The availability of children to actually come along here and grow the atmosphere of our club. Our club at the moment is at capacity where we are at Mace Oval. And being able to increase that capacity and build for the future, get kids out of the home, get them out here, get them out in an open facility in a sporting precinct such as this. It is a fantastic achievement.
What are we using at the moment?
So currently we use a 250 metre grass track. which the committee here make into an athletics track. It is just a community oval, which we mark out. We mark out once every 10 days during the season. It is very, very small for what we currently do. Within that 250 metres, sort of the inside of the oval, we have four high jumps, four discuses.
How hard did the committee have to push the Mornington Peninsula Shire and local politicians to make this happen?
We did push pretty hard through the social media campaign and through sort of at a committee level with the council. We did a lot of work in the background, and we found them very, very amenable to our demands, if that's the word you want to use. And the last meeting we had with the council, Carl Cowie came down, his CEO Alison came down. We had probably 10 people from the council there sitting around a round table having a discussion. And to be honest, to get that support from the council is fantastic. And knowing that they were behind us and it was just a matter of progression, how do we actually get this moving? It's a tremendous achievement by all.
With Chris Crowther on the campaign trail beefing up his policies and promises, we couldn't go past reminding him that ALP candidate for Dunkley, Ms. Peter Murphy, is hot on his heels for the seat. This is Chris Crowther's reaction to the close race.
Look, I think it's about listening to the community, listening to the grassroots about what they want for the electorate and actually advocating. And that's what's happened here today with the Mornington Little Ass. Obviously, we're both working very hard. We're both working with the community and trying to listen to the community. I think it's in terms of delivering results, as we've seen today. And Bruce Bilson's been a person who's delivered results for the last 20 years. And in his footsteps, I want to be that person that advocates half of the community and gets results like the $2 million facility here for the Mornington Little Ass here today in Mornington.
In closing, Mr. Hunt said the Little Athletics Track project will boost junior athletics participation rates across the Mornington Peninsula and Western Port. Up next, we hear about a new charity for young people.
98.7, 98.3, RPPFM Peninsula Radio.
There are many reasons why teenagers fall through the cracks and end up in trouble with the law, taking drugs, dropping out of school, and even homeless. And yes, it is happening in our backyard with at least 120 people sleeping on our local streets every night. Evidence shows that wayward teenagers who are falling through the cracks are either feeling pressure or bullied at school, including social media, living with domestic violence, not receiving attention or praise they need, and are not listened to enough. These are issues that need to be addressed. A charity that focuses on preventative action called Tomorrow's Heroes was launched last week to help young people be the best they can. Angela, who is the founder of the charity, speaks from personal experience about her teenage son. She has strong views how individuals and communities can help, believing we all have something to offer.
My son is a 100% visual learner. His greatest thing was to become the next Michael Jordan. His grade 6 teacher told me to send him to a particular high school because they're very sports orientated, and this school has got a few of the AFL players that come from this school. But in their wisdom, instead of working with him, they held the sport against him. He will not even look at basketball anymore. He doesn't even want to talk basketball anymore. He dropped out of school, especially the worst one was when he came home from school crying, and I found out just after his father died, and apparently a couple of the kids said, oh, it's no wonder your father died. He couldn't put up with a stupid kid like you because he was always in trouble, because in English and that, if you're not talking to him, he doesn't retain everything. So he started to fiddle, and instead of trying to get him to work with them, they'd send him out. And of course, he was bullied because of it. Every single one of us has something to offer to the community and to each other. We're not all the same. My thing is, if we embrace people's differences rather than hold it against them, we can all be enriched and all learn something from each other and all work together to make this world a much better place and a safer place for our kids. You've got parents who, like a friend of mine, got into uni with a 99.3% score. And her mother, instead of being over the moon, said, what happened to the other 0.7? That kind of attitude is what brings our kids down. That's the kind of attitude that makes them lose their confidence and don't want to thrive anymore. If we can all work together and see where these weaknesses are and try, like, I get these emails from America, and in America, you know, the footballers and the hockey players are all called jocks and they're all revered. So a group of them in some of the colleges have gotten together, and at lunchtime they'll sit with the kids that have been bullied. And the people who do the bullying think, well, if they're sitting with them, maybe they're cool, maybe they're not as bad as what we think. And they're changing that outlook by doing that. And if we can do that sort of thing, getting other people involved to help that way, or rewards for when they do not bully, that they start to work with these kids and reward that behaviour, maybe we can change it, that people will get the help they need instead of being, you know, put down because they're different.
Norbert Greitzer has a vision to set up a committee to help young people on the peninsula who are falling through the cracks.
Running a number of programs for youth, I saw the need in spending a lot of time down here, what is happening for those young people or older people, in fact, who are falling through the cracks, that there was a niche for us to try and get involved with groups that are already down here to try and help put together a total program so the cracks don't exist anymore and young people don't fall through. And I think it's important with children and grandchildren today. I feel very passionate about trying to help young people who are missing out on the life that my children and my grandchildren have. I've set up a lot of committees, but I'm not about setting up big committees. I want a small constructive team that's going to be really passionate about doing the right thing to try and connect all the groups that are already out there, work together as a team and do something special to help young people in the areas that they need. So you see young children who don't communicate with their parents, who don't communicate with their friends. That's part of the new, you know, the new times now with notebook computers and everything else. They just don't connect with the elders and parents. But I was always surrounded by older people who always talked to me. I communicate. I did the same with my children. I sat down with them every week on a Sunday night, talked about the week that was, the week to come. What do you see? What would you like to do? Et cetera, et cetera. I don't see that happening today anymore. And I think that's part of what needs to be changed, that listening to young people, telling you what they think they'd like to do and trying to create something special to for them to achieve it. People have been very supportive of what we're doing. There'll be donations made towards this so we can help the youth and utilise that money to help fill those gaps.
The Mornington Peninsula Shire has come on board with Tomorrow's Heroes, recognising strategies such as strength-based pathways need to be in place. But federal cuts make it difficult to obtain what's needed to move forward. Seawinds Ward Councillor Antonella Celli concludes by explaining how she and the Shire are embarking on a mission to help.
Well, through our research on the Mornington Peninsula, we've actually identified at least about 120 people that are actually doing it rough at nights across the Mornington Peninsula. So we identify them as being homeless and needing extra social welfare services and support. But as Chair of the Health and Wellbeing Committee for the municipality, we're actually very aware of the strategies that need to be in place to address these issues of homelessness on the Mornington Peninsula. So we have things like the Second Bite program that runs out of the Rosebud Memorial Hall once a week. And we've also just started up the trial for 6 weeks of the Orange Sky Laundromat Service at Vinnie's Hall there in Rosebud that will be helping our homeless, assisting them with their laundry. The Mornington Peninsula in the last couple of years has really faced significant federal funding cuts at our social welfare frontline services, and that has affected the quality of services and the frequency of services that are available to our marginalised and vulnerable in the community. So working together in partnership with charities such as Tomorrow's Heroes and other philanthropic and benevolent societies in our community and support and information centres, we can come together and actually help address strength-based pathways to help people in our community.
Strong messages and a need for preventative action came out of Tomorrow's Heroes launch. If you want to get on board or find out more about the charity, get in touch with Angela at info@fusionchocolates.com.au or contact Norbert on 0412 608 019. A website and Facebook page will be set up soon. Thanks to Heather Miles for getting behind the charity and hosting the launch at her cafe, BBC in Macrae. Heather is also a presenter at RPFM with her Friday program called Mornings with Heather Mack. Coming up, we hear more on the summer's footpaths. But first, with a double disillusion this year in the upcoming federal election, the voting public have their say which parties they want to be represented in the Senate. Australian Sex Party candidate for Victoria, Dr. Meredith Doig, seems an unlikely runner with her business and boardroom background to associate with a party with such name. But here is what she had to say about the Australian Sex Party and their policies.
The Australian Sex Party has been going as a party not very long. We're still in our childhood, moving into our adolescence. It began in 2009. Some people may not realise that the Australian Sex Party got more votes in its first outing than the Greens did when they first started contesting elections. So we got off to a very strong start. I think like a number of people, I was not immediately attracted by the name, but when I got to read the policies of the Sex Party, that's when I really became very interested in them and decided to throw my weight and my support behind them.
What sort of issues are you advocating yourself, and even some of the policies that the Sex Party is putting forward in this election?
We are unashamedly a socially progressive party. But economically, I think it's fair to say that we're more prudent. That is, we're not in favour of larger government and more bureaucracy. We're more in favour of smaller government and giving people the more freedom. We are a civil liberties party, so we're in favour of more freedom, but freedom with responsibility. Environmental side of things, I guess you could say that we're a party that is not ideological when it comes to environmental matters, but more rational. I mean, in other words, we would look at the science and the evidence about what works for environmental matters rather than just taking an ideological line.
When the question was put to Dr. Doig about the type of voter likely to vote for the Australian Sex Party, she replied,
"That's a really interesting question, because in some ways one would imagine that with a name like ours, we might attract younger people and people who are a bit out there. But, you know, if I take myself as an example, I spent most of my career in the corporate world. I've been around big business, small business. For the last 15 years or so, I've been on a number of boards. So I'm a much more middle-of-the-road sort of person, but I'm attracted to the actual policies of the Sex Party. We've got people who are in their 80s and 90s who say that they vote for the Sex Party. We've got parents with young children, and they're attracted by our policies as well. If people can just get behind the name to read our policies, I think they can appeal to a broad cross-section of people."
What can you bring to the party?
I've had 40 years experience in the corporate world and in small business. I was on the board of Baker's Delight, also I'm pretty familiar with
the bread
what it's
business.
Like for at least franchisees and small yep. business people. I've run my own consulting business, so these days it seems as though you've almost got to run yourself like a small business. And I've also taught governance at the Institute of Company Directors. I would bring to the job of being a senator a lot of experience in business, but not being beholden to anyone. I've been very active in my career in community organisations. I was part of the women's electoral lobby in the 80s and 90s, and then I'm also a motorcyclist, and I became the
wow.
secretary of the Australian Federation of Motorcyclists. So I am a bit of a joiner. I tend to want to get in and make a difference. So what I can bring to the role of being a senator for Victoria is somebody who is independent, but a voice for reason. One of the last 5 years, I've been president of an organisation called the Rationalist Society. We're in favour of science and evidence as opposed to superstition and bigotry. So I'd like to think that I could bring a voice for reason in the National Parliament and be independent of vested interests.
With changes in the Senate voting system, how do you think the Sex Party will fare in the Senate now? Is it a fair system, do you think?
Look, I think it's fair to say that the changes to the system were not in our best interest, because like many other people who are part of smaller so-called micro parties, the previous system enabled us to be able to have a fair go at getting elected. The previous system was probably less than transparent, even though the information about how one's preferences would be distributed, even though that information was available, it was quite complex, I think, for voters to understand it. So the changes to the system have disadvantaged us, but I'm hoping that people will see the new system as a way that they can hopefully give us their first vote above the line, vote one sex party, even if they are rusted on Liberal or National or Greens or Labor. I'm hoping that we can attract their second preference in order to make sure that the Senate has a diverse range of people, because I do think that the diversity in the upper house has been an advantage to Australia, and to sort of have a bit of a check and balance against the excesses that might come from the lower house.
Is it possible the Australian Sex Party could have representation in the House of Reps in time to come?
The Sex Party did gain more votes than the Greens did at its first outing. So down the track, it's not beyond the realms of possibility. We'd have to say that that's a medium-term goal rather than shorter-term.
Are there enough parties in the Senate to represent the Australian majority?
No, I don't think there are enough parties in the Senate to represent Australia as a whole and the diversity of Australia. That's why we think that it's really important that people, when they're voting this time round, make sure that they give preferences on. Hopefully we could get their first vote, but at least if people could choose sex party number two or three in their list of preferences so that we can sort of keep the bastards honest in the upper house.
The Senate candidate spoke about policies the Australian Sex Party is advocating that will support the people on the Mornington Peninsula and local communities.
Danger with the new system is that people will tend to vote just for their the same party as they voted for in the lower house. What that will do is just restrict the diversity in the upper house to match up with the lower house. And it means that we don't get those different voices coming in and saying, hang on a sec, let's just have a look at this from a different perspective.
Catholicism and Christianity are subject matters, Dr. Doig, and the party question.
So there's a number of things that we think are really important, but let me just say the one that I personally think is really important. I would really like to expose and to counteract what I think is the insidious influence of the religious right wing in public policy. Ever since John Howard's era, the influence of conservative Catholics and evangelical Protestants has grown to a point where I think even many believers are really quite uncomfortable. You only have to look at what's come out through the Royal Commission into Institutional Child Abuse to see how the behaviour of some people in religious institutions has gone unaccounted and unaccountable for too long. Many of the policies that socially progressive people would like to see instituted, for example, equal marriage, voluntary euthanasia, these are policies that a vast majority of Australians are in favour of, and yet the major impediment appears to be conservative Catholics and evangelical Protestants. So I would really like to highlight this fact and to expose these people to a public debate about the nature of their influence and how they are not reflecting the majority of Australians' views on these sorts of matters.
Well, we are a Christian country above all.
We are a country that has a Christian history, and the Christian church indeed has been very important and should be understood and should be valued in Australian society for those people who believe in Christianity. The assumption that the majority of Australians are Christian will be challenged at the census coming up in August. Mm. There's a lot more people who are ticking no religion, but beyond that, I think there are people who might tick a Christian box in the census, but merely because they were born into that sort of family. They're not an active
No, they're not practicing.
They simply tick that box because that's the nature of the family they were born into, but it's really irrelevant to their day-to-day lives.
So will you vote for the Australian Sex Party in this election? Thanks to Deborah Maher for compiling that report with the Australian Sex Party Senate candidate for Victoria, Dr. Meredith Doig. Ahead on Eye on the Peninsula, summer's footpaths.
This is 98.7, 98.3 RPPFM.
Last week, Eye on the Peninsula captured the tension and divisiveness erupting between Summers residents over proposed concrete footpaths in the seaside township. Part of the anger is over the Summers Path Network special charge scheme, the Mornington Peninsula Shire's plan to apportion costs among all Summers property owners, not just those fronting the footpaths. Just to recap, at the beginning of this month, Summers residents who opposed the special charge scheme attended a VCAT practice hearing with the Shire's legal team. VCAT's Vice President, Mr. Dwyer, is requesting further detail concerning Section 185AA of the application and more transparency from the Shire. The outcome of the practice hearing detailed a compulsory case conference and mediation session scheduled for the 18th of August between the Shire and the Summers residents. The actual VCAT hearing is scheduled for October the 24th this year. Everyone has different opinions why they want or don't want a footpath. Here are two locals who also want to share theirs.
I support paths because I'm a mother of four, and I also am very aware that Summers has changed. It's not just changing, it has changed. So consequently, we have to change with it, and infrastructure needs to match how much busier it is. And we can argue all we like, but it is a busier place, the roads are busier, and we need the place to be safe. My main concerns are children on the road, on their bikes, or walking along the verge of the road, prams, and wheelchair access, and elderlies in those little pokemobile carts. So we're talking right across the demographics. Lots of friends that have had incidents on bikes, when they're running, walking your dog. The fact is, it is busy, and unless you just halve the population and go back to the 1950s, you actually need to embrace a little bit of change and also provide safety and accessibility. I don't mean the whole place, but I also think concrete is the safest option because it doesn't need maintaining, it doesn't get all the ruts on it, it doesn't get all the erosion on it. I don't mind paying for it.
I do agree with it, especially down the main thoroughfares where Camp Hill Road is a 70 kilometre an hour zone and it turns into a 40 at the roundabout and down past the school. However, that part that's 70 kilometres an hour, the road's quite narrow. There is a path along Sandy Point Road and it just finishes. So if you were riding your bike or walking into Summers, it finishes, and if you want to go down the store, you've got to go on this road with the potholes and the soft edges. That road is also the main thoroughfare for children riding their bikes to school.
Now, what do you think about the scheme?
I think it's a lot fairer than just expecting the people along the route to pay a lot more if it's spread amongst the community because the whole community benefits.
So which Summers anti-path group is the most vocal? Who is the Shire listening to?
There's been lots of transparency.
Yes, if people were following it and didn't have their own agendas, they would see that all the information has been available. From my point of view, I've found that some of the anti-pathway people have been the ones who have been the most vocal and bullying and angry. And they have got their point across through media. But the council has seen survey results and most of the population said they wanted a path, and this has been going on for 5 or 6 years, but when it came down to money, that's when it became even more divisive. But there seems to be different factions of each camp, because originally people were saying, yes, we want a path, but we don't want it to be concrete. But the council said legally it has to be a solid concrete surface, and it was put forward to be pebblecrete and it looked like the one in Sorrento. That's what the SRA were negotiating with the council for. So anything that happened after that negotiation with the SRA, who are just really speaking for their members, if they've changed anything about the path, it's been the council, because the SRA have no say or power. But they'd become the real scapegoats to this whole thing. But really, they're just a vessel for people to communicate with the council. Fundamentally, I'm for a path that is safe for people to be able to walk along.
The proposed footpath route is along Lord Summers, Camp Hill, Tasman and South Beach roads, Parklands Avenue and the Boulevard at a total cost of $1.5 million. The amount of the Summers Path Network special charge scheme will be levied at $750,000. Eye on the Peninsula will continue to report on the Summers footpath dispute, which is dividing the small township. Deborah Maher reporting. The First 1,000 Days of Australia project is a program to support Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders strengthen their culture by focusing on children and families. Sina Summers sourced information about the project from various people in the medical field, starting with
Professor Kerry Arabina from Melbourne University spoke recently at an event in Hastings about a groundbreaking program called The First 1,000 Days Australia. This was recently cited in the National Children's Commissioner's Report on Children's Rights. This model looks at new approaches to working with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander families and specifically the children of today so that they can develop into great parents of the future. Professor Kerry Arabina and her team have designed a program that is focused on transformational change. Let's have a listen.
Talk a little bit today about this notion of the first 1,000 days. There's no better time to do work for our kids than right now. I believe that the way we view Aboriginal families is through a lens which tells us that there are so many things wrong with our families that we've forgotten what's right about them. And what we're not doing is focusing on what it means to be successful people who have been here and part of this landscape for 60,000 plus years. And I am very much guided by the community-controlled health sector's view on what it means to have holistic health and well-being. And in terms of the fact that an individual is contextualised in families and community is absolutely front and centre of my worldview. I also hold very clearly that Australia has certain obligations under the United Nations Declarations on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples to meet and honour, and that we ourselves have the full potential for not only human rights, but Indigenous rights. And that's why I think the work of the First 1,000 Days was picked up very clearly through Megan Mitchell's work, who is the Children's Commissioner, who's looking at children's rights in particular. And so our children not only have human rights, they have a right to be heard, and they have a right to their indigeneity as Indigenous children. And that's globally contextualised as well.
Professor Kerry Arabina addresses some of today's issues.
The invisibility of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander men. Stop with the child and maternal health services. Honestly, it takes two people to make a baby where I come from. And it also means then that what we've got is this invisibility. What kind of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander man is going to head up to a child and maternal health service? And why aren't we spending time focusing on men and helping them make that incredible life transition, socialise our men into becoming fathers, celebrate their capacity for nurturance and fatherhood?
This groundbreaking program offers some new approaches.
If we make these early life investments, kids are going to want to get to school. They're going to want to be able to perform and engage. Kids that can't attend school full time because of behavioural and developmental reasons, and so one of the things that we really wanted to do was change the agenda from one of school preparation to one that addresses developmental delays early so that kids are better prepared for school. And if we can get to them before they're age two, all the neuroplasticity in their mind, all of the ways in which they are socialised, all of the trauma triggers that are associated with living in vulnerable families, if you can address that by the time they're two, then actually they're going to make the transition into kindy incredibly well, and primary school is going to be so much more enhanced.
The First 1,000 Days is based on a holistic model, and Kerry is looking for a collaborative approach to make this a success.
We cannot do this by health alone. We do need to bring in early learning services. We need to bring in education. We do need child protection. We actually need to have justice at the table. We need family violence workers. We need elders. We need all of these other people so that we can address these things together. So changing the marginal position of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people is not only the job of us, but for all Australians. We all should be invested in equity. We all need the same opportunities without being made the same. Culturally, we are significant and we are different. We need to strengthen culture, not tear it down. And we need to start with women and their partners and their extended family and communities and focus on infants and young children and from there then proceed across the life course. The way that we start to define the first 1,000 days for us, if you haven't worked it out yet, I am talking from conception through to age 2.
Dr. Rebecca Ritter, an epidemiologist working closely with Professor Kerry Arabina, talked about a new approach to scientific study in relation to the first 1,000 days project.
As scientists, we tend to observe, measure, and prod and probe, but we also still need to change what's happening within children, so there's an intervention that needs to happen. And how we're going to measure these health outcomes, the service provision, and also the well-being measures, we would ask to do a cohort study. A cohort study tends to be an observational one, but people there said, no, not an observational one, an interventional one. When you see a vulnerable family, you have to get in there and do something about it. You're going to have to look at a strength-based one, where we measure successful outcomes, the well-being, emotional well-being, and cultural protective factors. And also, who's in charge? Not the scientists. Kerry's in charge. We've got a governance committee that's also in charge, which is Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people qualified to be able to lead this particular study. This is flipping the whole paradigm of doing science on its head. We need to have research, we need to have data, we need to have grants, we need to have manuscripts. No, that's the wrong way to do it. We need to actually be starting from talking, getting engagement. So from my point of view as a scientist, I think what's really great about what's with ONEMDA and the Indigenous Health Equity Unit is that we're going to be changing this. This is being led and it's going to be new knowledge. We can show that we can do epidemiology and science in a different way.
Kerry continues to talk about what's needed to make this happen.
So we're looking for locally driven approaches and we're going to be talking about empowerment. And we're going to have a whole range of different measures, not just biological ones, but ones that are about family well-being, social emotional well-being, and cultural measures. We're also going to be able to measure the impact and change in services. We're looking to develop a workforce, and part of our role now is around curriculum development. And we're innovative because what we're doing now isn't working. This is Indigenous-led, and its implementation will be controlled and measured by a partnership led through the University of Melbourne. We have got about 7 or 8 national and international partners who are part of that program, but it's led by us out of our unit. We are after transformation. This is radicalising transformation. This is an incremental change. I will not wait 45 years before me and my people achieve health equity. If we're on course for 2030, we need to make some pretty important decisions together as peoples and as fellow Australians achieving equity. It actually works better for all of us. And what we will do, we'll partner effectively with you. We'll be the academic conveners when you need us to come in and do things. We'll create scientific evidence. We'll design, implement, and evaluate all of the different interventions. We'll implement knowledge exchange, evaluate your initiatives, we'll facilitate the Perth cohort, and we will partner alongside you for as long as it takes. Localised decision-making, place-based strategies, intervention work, family focus, bringing men into the picture, entrepreneurial thinking and action, local innovation, being supported all the way through, creating a new workforce is actually going to shift some things along quickly. Our children in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities, majority of us are under the age of 21, and the greatest majority of that group is under the age of 15. And this mirrors a global phenomenon which is unseen in human times. This is the largest number of adolescents of one species alive at any time on the planet in the history of humanity. There have never been a larger number of 13 to 19 year olds ever. So our kids are going to have to participate in education, they are going to have to build businesses, and the kind of jobs that they're going to have aren't even begun to be thought of yet. there are different kinds of opportunities that are emerging in this space, which is extraordinary. And all of this, we've got increasing environmental vulnerability, and I think that the oldest living culture in the world might actually have some powerful lessons for all of us to learn. So in terms of all of this, it is our collective responsibility not only to do the right thing to achieve equity, because the equity is in everyone's business, but to future-proof our way of life for all of our kids. And I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much for listening.
I spoke with Deb Mellett, who is working with the Maternal and Child Health Unit at the Mornington Peninsula Shire, and this is what she had to say about this program.
Well, I first came across the 1,000 Days when I was doing some research on early years. I saw a report from one of the scientific symposiums that Kerry was talking about in her presentation, and it just blew my mind completely. Prior to that, I'd been to a dementia workshop, and they had a professor and a brain surgeon from New South Wales. Right. And he talked about how you look after yourself in pregnancy and you can actually stop dementia. And the more I learnt about this, the more I wanted to know. And I thought, well, I'm actually writing up my work plan at the moment, and I really want this embedded in to the work I'm doing.
I found it really thought-provoking.
That's what we were hoping to achieve, is to stop organisations just looking at their work as solos and what we can do collectively. Like, it's almost like a plan for the family. Let them choose how and where they want to go and what programs best suit them. But to get organisations thinking not just about what they're running, but what is best for a family. And if you're nurturing the whole family, the baby is going to be really well looked after.
And looking at changing some social norms too, involving dads in a different way.
Yeah, so culturally, in Aboriginal culture, if you were in a traditional sense, the males wouldn't come in until teenagers, you know, around 11 or 12, the fathers would start getting involved. It was women's business prior to that. But what we're saying now is that as a diverse culture and living in an urban situation, we haven't got the extended family situations most of the time. And so we want to empower dads. We want to bring them along right from the very start. Mm. So we've got this beautiful window of opportunity from conception to two to put as much information into that baby's brain and nurturing and mother-father bonding with this child to make a real impact later on.
Holistically, it's not just the physical, it's the emotional, it's the mental, it's spiritual.
All of those things are really important. This is why my project, I'm calling it Cool and Bub Up, Healthy Children. We're trying to do this so that we're setting them up.
So this is on the Mornington Peninsula and Frankston?
Yes.
Yeah, right.
But it looks like, you know, there's potential for it to grow.
It's very exciting. Very exciting. Deb Mellett, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thanks to Sina Summers for compiling that report. Hope you've enjoyed this week's Eye on the Peninsula. If you have any news from the street you want to share with our team, please contact RPPFM on 5975 1234. Next week, Eye on the Peninsula will once again bring you up to date with issues that matter to you. We hope you can tune in next Tuesday at noon on 98.7 FM or 98.3 Frankston. You can live stream from our website, rpfm.com.au, and download the RPPFM app. If you miss any Eye on the Peninsula programs, podcasts are available on our website, and check out the Eye on the Peninsula Facebook page. Thank you to Deborah Maher, executive producer of Eye on the Peninsula, Sina Summers, and Kevin Wilcox, our news researcher. I'm Piers Cunningham. Thanks for your company.